Welcome to Appearance Matters, the podcast, the appearance psychology podcast brought to you by the Centre for Appearance Research, a world-leading research centre based at the University of the West of England in Bristol, investigating everything related to the psychology of how we look. I'm Nadia, and in recognition that April is Autism Acceptance Month, this episode is on body image in autistic people with a long-time listener and friend of the show, Fedra Longhurst. As a quick introduction, Fedra is an autistic PhD student at the Body and Self Group, Anglo-Ruskin University, where she is investigating positive body image in autistic individuals using a mixed methods design. As part of her PhD, Fedra has recently published a qualitative study exploring the ways in which positive body image is defined and characterised by autistic people. Building upon this work, she's also just published a paper where she has revised the commonly used Body Appreciation Scale 2 for use in the autistic community, named, using the abbreviation, BAS2A. Beyond her PhD, Fedra's research focuses on body image and appearance-related studies and developing positivist interventionist methods which promote healthier body image across diverse populations, in particular the wider disabled community. I'm so happy to be able to share this conversation I had with Fedra just last week, where we spoke about both of the aforementioned papers, so the qualitative interview study on positive body image in autistic adults and the adaptation of the body appreciation scale, in addition to a scoping review she also published on body image and autism. As always, links to all three of the papers are in our episode show notes. Right, I don't want to waste any more time, so we are going to jump straight in with Fedra explaining to me what autism is.
So I always underappreciate how actually not everyone knows what autism is, because I'm autistic, and so I just think, yeah, everyone knows what it is and knows all the ins and outs. But yeah, I think that's a really good question to ask and to start off with. And I think, so defining what autism is quite difficult and very muddy, because I don't know what the phrase is exactly, where it's kind of like, if you meet one autistic person, you have met one autistic person. So I think what autism is, it's not monolithic. So it's completely different for each person, and it's not universally experienced. And so when we say spectrum, like, that is not a linear spectrum either. It's like so holistically experienced and should be holistically understood. But to put it as simply as possible in a little bow for you, is like, it's understood as like a neurodevelopmental difference. So some people might refer to it as a condition. However, more autistic advocates have recently sort of pushing towards understanding it as a difference, kind of like shifting away from like a pathologizing view of it. And so we understand it that autistic people describe having alternative communication styles. So for example, the most common way of describing this is like, some people are either minimally speaking or nonverbal completely. So for example, my verbal communication can really differ. So when I was a child, I was nonverbal up until I was about maybe 5 or 6, can't quite remember. And up until in my 20s, my vocabulary was pretty limited. And now, whilst I may appear to be speaking completely fine, I'm actually prefer to be minimally speaking. And so the next part, similarly, is like having socializing preferences. So we have quite different social needs to some other autistic people, to neurotypical people. Another common hallmark is sensory processing. Having self-regulatory behaviours, so having repetitive or stimulatory movements, so things like hand flapping or rocking, things like that. And on that note, it's having intense interests as well, which we have recently theorised as monotropism. So having very intense, hyper-focused interests and referring back to sensory processing differences. What I mean by that is there's quite a few things. So we often have altered interoception. So that is having subjective awareness of our internal bodily stimuli, so things like hunger and thirst. We can often have something called alexithymia. So that's our awareness of and being able to describe emotional feelings. And also we may have differing extraception. So that is hypo or hypersensory sensitivities to external sensory stimuli. So things like touch, taste, smell, hearing. So I am quite sensory seeking when it comes to things like taste. I love like really intense food, but then I pretty much always have like earplugs on or ear defenders on because I hate noise, basically. And because, interestingly enough, quite recently we've come to understand that because it's quite new research, the prevalence rates differ quite substantially, but anywhere between 50 to 70% of autistic people will also be diagnosed or self-identify as having ADHD, myself included. And so what that also means is quite a common thing is having executive functioning differences. So for example, that refers to things like working memory, our abilities to plan, execute tasks, often those that involve a lot of multitasking, which is a bit like, what am I doing? Where am I going? So for example, I will be sat in my room and I'm like, I'm really, really thirsty. If I'm able to recognize the fact that I'm thirsty, and I'll go down to the kitchen. And by the time that I've gotten to the kitchen, I'm a bit like, I've forgotten what I'm doing without having like an external reminder to tell me you're here to get a drink. So I always have to leave a glass by the sink to be like, Phaedra, you need to get a glass of water. So it's like a visual cue, like, ah, okay, that's why I'm here. And I need to get a drink. Whereas without that glass, I'll just go, oh, okay. And I'll probably start looking at the birds in the garden or doing something completely different. And then 2 hours later, I think, God, I feel really like a desert. Why do I feel so thirsty? And it's because I haven't had a drink all morning. So that's just like a little bit of a whistle-stop tour of autism. And probably so many people are like, you have missed out this and this and this, but that is as simply as I can put it.
No, that's wonderful, and thank you so much for putting it together in a concise bow for me. I really appreciate that, and I'm already learning a lot, and thank you also for sharing your own experience and for speaking, especially as you're saying that you prefer really not to be. So I feel even more honoured that you said yes to speaking to me for this podcast, and I think that also just gives us a really strong foundation for the rest of our conversation. So one more question I have before we get to the topic of body image is, I think it's fair to say we both have an interest in eating disorders. For example, we're both very active members of the Academy for Eating Disorders, and we're in New York, for example, last month for the International Conference on Eating Disorders. And I know there's been a real increase in research in the relationship between autism and eating disorders, and studies are showing autistic people are at higher risk of both anorexia and ARFID. And I'm curious to hear from you, like, why is that? I wonder if you could just speak a little on it.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I'll be completely transparent and say that I have lived experience of having anorexia and also ARFID as well. And that's a whole nother, like, the two and two are like, where are we? Such an overlap, and I think still now we still need a much better understanding of differentiating the two. But yeah, so I have lived experience of both, and I might be jumping the gun a little bit, but it's basically that lived experience is what has informed my research, and I think that's the case for a lot of researchers in eating disorders and body image, but not to generalize. And it's a really hard one, again, to put really succinctly, but I think there's two points I'll start off with that I think are worth acknowledging. So, firstly, the one reason why this is quite difficult to answer is because personally, not just personally, I think this is like a quite a common thought or opinion in the literature, is that research has been quite limited in terms of meaningfully differentiating between eating disorder pathology, whether that would be restrictive eating disorder, so like you say, anorexia or ARFID, but also other related or other eating disorders like binge eating and bulimia, is that we are struggling to really decipher what is eating disorder pathology and what is autistic eating needs and behaviors. So what I mean by that is a lot of commonly used measures for eating disorders, such as like the E26, is they refer to a lot of eating behaviors that are actually quite universally experienced for autistic folks and might actually be adaptive for us, which is quite weird to think. So, for example, we may, because of our sensory processing needs or hypersensitivities, we may be quite follow a limited repertoire of foods or like meals that we feel safe, quote unquote, safe to eat. And through the neurotypical lens, quite quickly that looks like a form of pathology for some people. And that needs kind of to be addressed, which to a degree in some contexts, I understand why that might be if people are not meeting their nutritional needs. But at the same time, I think for a long time, a lot of our behaviors have been pathologized when really they should just be kind of seen through a strength-based lens. So we're actually adapting to our own bodily needs in a way that is actually quite in tune to, like I say, our like need to kind of feel safe around food, safe within our bodies. And so that is, at the moment, there is that kind of sticking point in the literature. So what I think the reason why I'm saying this is the reason why people think that eating disorders are so common in autistic people is actually because maybe our understanding of eating disorders might not actually be in line with our experience. And secondly, the research has always really heavily looked at quote unquote comorbid autism in eating disorders. So often they would have referred to women who or girls who are presenting an eating disorder or being treated for an eating disorder and then get diagnosed with autism. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And I think it's great that there's now treatment pathways like the PEACE pathway established by King's College where they help identify autism in those who have not yet been diagnosed, which is great and helps people understand their experience and how they've been going about their day-to-day lives or throughout their childhood, and probably have a lot of unanswered questions that are then suddenly become answered through having a diagnosis, which is great. But unfortunately, through that, there is still the question of, so what is it like for autistic people with an eating disorder? So they might already know that they've got autism and still having to navigate what it's like or how to deal with the eating disorder. And so that also still poses a lot of theoretical and practical limitations because a lot of the existing treatments and assessment tools and things like that aren't actually designed for us in mind. So a lot of the points that I've previously made, so like our eating behaviors and just attitudes and needs, aren't quite well accommodated for. And so that might actually increase our risk for the prolonged or in longer enduring eating disorders. So we're often famously known to be hard to treat or resistant to treatment. But at the moment, it is very much argued by the autistic community that our needs aren't just being met. So that's two very long tangents for you, sorry. But
Please don't apologize. So I'm hanging on your every word. It's so fascinating to me, and I think there's so much more work to be done in this space, but it's so valuable just to have that immediate insight into a conversation that I think we're seeing a lot about, or definitely an increasing volume about, in that eating disorder space. So thank you for sharing. So now let's get into talking about body image in autistic people. So before we get into your qualitative work about positive body image, I wonder if you could speak quite generally. What do we know? Can you give us an overview about body image in autistic people?
Not a whole lot.
That was easy.
Yeah. For some reason, like a lot of marginalised communities, I think, not to use neurodivergent too loosely, because I think it's quite a poorly used word, but neurodivergent communities have been quite overseen. And that is no exception to autistic people. For some reason, why, I have no idea, because I think we're a fascinating bunch. Our bodies work completely differently, I feel, in some ways, and in many ways we don't differ at all. So I conducted, right at the very start of my PhD, I conducted a scoping review, just to, because that's what you tend to do at the start of your PhD, is to look what's been covered. And fortunately, but also not that fortunately for me, because it's meant me thinking, oh God, where do I even begin? Not a whole lot has been done. But what we do know is very much limited to what we would refer to as like the clinical population. So those with an eating disorder, or interestingly enough, quite contradictory weight management. So very two extremes. So either in the eating disorder community, or those who quote unquote are seeking treatment for their weight, which is absolutely, not to be too opinionated, but just a bit gross, to be honest. But what we do know, only four qualitative studies at the time of doing this review, only four qualitative studies were identified. And basically it was obvious that autistic people experience negative body image or body dissatisfaction like the rest of the population. That shouldn't really come as a surprise, but for some people, for some reason, that is. And what was interesting is that a lot of the underlying mechanisms or processes for negative body image were quite unique for autistic people. So they would refer to these as like autism specific factors. So there's three predominant ones, which I can briefly discuss. So the first being the sensory difficulties. So like I've been saying, we have a lot of hypo or hypersensitivities to external but also internal stimuli. So the fact that we can be so sensitive to things like food, textures, sounds, light, so forth, they're negative bodily experiences. They're not very pleasant. And that can have an effect of how you feel within your body. So no, they're not exactly appearance related concerns. And to a degree, that is actually still the case. I have found that our body image isn't just about the appearance. I'll talk more about this later, but it's also the sensory experience. But yeah, so people would experience the fact that having these negative bodily experiences just within their environment can be quite uncomfortable, and that can have an impact on how they perceive themselves. Relatedly, we have a lot of research was looking at differences in body awareness. So again, things like alexithymia and having interoceptive awareness differences. So the fact that we can often forget to eat and drink can make us feel quite uncomfortable, and therefore have a harder time with navigating food or eating. But also just in terms of like emotional regulation or understanding our emotions can be quite uncomfortable. So we'll have like these intense physical like experiences. So everyone knows that being upset or anxious is quite an uncomfortable physical experience, but sometimes people might not understand that that is what is happening. But either way, it's not a comfortable experience, so that can cause a lot of body dissatisfaction. And lastly, and most importantly, autistic people experience a lot of discrimination and stigma. So because we act quite differently, we talk quite differently, we experience a lot of marginalization and discrimination. And so that can cause us to mask, so hide our autistic quirks, characteristics, however you want to phrase them. And that can really just kind of make you feel quite detached from yourself because you're not going about your day to day living authentically and true to who you are. You're always trying to put on a facade and not listening to your own needs. And that can make you feel very detached from your body. So that is basically the very few pieces that we knew and beforehand, before my PhD.
That all makes a lot, as you're speaking, it makes so much sense to me. It really feels, it's like an expanded understanding of body image as well for autistic people, but it just really has that last point you were saying about the discrimination and the masking and that concealment stress and how that has that impact on how you feel in your body as a facet of a body image. So yeah, really, really insightful. So let's talk about your qualitative study on positive body image in autistic individuals. I love the title quote, "There's no separating my view of my body from my autism." And I'd love to hear what you found. But before we get there, could you say a little bit about who you interviewed and the kinds of things that you were asking your interviewees?
I'm glad you mentioned the quote in my title, because when the person said it, I was like, oh, that's a golden nugget for a title.
Nice. I love it when that happens.
Yeah. But it's also really, I felt quite icky for thinking that. I was like, oh God, I can't believe I'm thinking of my title already. That's really gross. But anyway. So yeah, I basically, because what I did for my qualitative study is I used something called constructivist grounded theory. For non-researchers, that essentially means it's quite a convoluted way of conducting qualitative research to try and, basically the aim of it is to establish a new theory. What that means, well, I don't know. I don't know how to describe that in the most simplest of terms. But basically you're just trying to create like a very holistic understanding of a lived phenomena in a certain population. And so we knew that there was a working theory of positive body image in generally, but also for other disabled folks. So those with like a physical disability, like spinal cord injury. So it just seemed like a natural way of approaching this question is using grounded theory. And also we use photo elicitation technique. So I'll just put that out there randomly, only because for those who are listening, if you're interested in work in marginalized communities, particularly within the disabled space, these kind of collaborative participatory tools are a really great way to kind of do this future work. So if I could ever raise that awareness to people, I'd take the opportunity to really have a look in those tools, because especially in this community we have a lot of different communication differences, like I've been saying. And so photo elicitation or photo voice can be a really great way to kind of have more, make research more accessible and inclusive to our needs. So with that in mind, I approached, I spoke to 20 autistic folks based in the UK. So that involves, so across gender identities, so men, women and non-binary or agender. And across of age range, so I think the youngest was 18 and the eldest was, I think, maybe in their late 50s. So I think roughly 56. And also these folks, although BMI is not the best way to refer to body size, but by all means, by capturing their BMI, we were able to determine diversity of body types. So we were across the board, which was really lovely. However, because of the whole nature of autism at the moment, a lot of like racialized minorities are still kind of being excluded from like accessing diagnosis and things like that. So we were, I think it was like 80% white, but unfortunately
that's roughly reflective of a UK population also.
That is true, yeah. So that is just always something worth considering going forward. It's like, so while we wanted to refer to a diverse, like reach certain sub-communities within the autistic population, we weren't able to get all of them. And also, it's also worth stating that all participants were verbal speaking. So our sample didn't refer to those minimally or non-verbal. So that is some, again, jumping the gun, but some work that needs to be done in the future.
Yeah, awesome. And I'd just love to hear a little bit more about the photo elicitation and the photo voice methodology that you used. So what kind of, did you ask people to bring in photos, or how did that work?
Yeah, so there's a few ways that you can approach photo voice or photo elicitation, whichever phrase term you want to use. So often, one way of going about it is that the researcher already selects a series of photos, so they'll then present these to the participant. But that's often for children, I think. And I think that's just to make it a bit more easier for kids, basically, because often kids are a bit like, what? But in my case, I always give the interview questions beforehand just to help with any, to ease any level of uncertainty or of anxiety. But also with those questions, I ask participants to just either take new photos or select existing photos that they felt would help them talk through their experiences. Because talking about your body, I think for the general population, is a bit of a weird thing to do anyway, both for negative and positive experiences. But because of the factors that I've previously talked about, so things like body awareness and things like that, just adds another kind of barrier potentially for communicating those experiences. And so using photos can be quite a nice way of, assisting the communication of these experiences, but also it can help the participant feel less like they're in a hierarchy. So it helps create like more of an even keel. So they are like, we are here to serve them essentially. And I want to tell their story as authentically as possible. And so it just helps them really kind of fully collaborate in the process of creating that research and disseminating their lived experience, basically. And so that is how we went about it in this way. So often they would literally take photos, or they would use pieces of art. I had one participant share life drawing paintings that they created to kind of talk about, so something called proprioception. So a huge part of their experiences was about like using force within their body, because often we can feel like, I don't know how to put it, but at least for me, I feel like I'm floating in space all the time. I don't quite know where I am. And so like physical contact can be like, or like squeezing sensation can be really quite a nice experience. So they use their life drawings to kind of communicate that, which I thought was lovely. I had a great time listening to that and sharing these images with them. So that's how we went about it in my study.
Yeah, that's so cool. I love that inclusion of the life drawings as well. And to your point about using photo voice or photo elicitation to break down that hierarchy, I can really see that, because the person who is the expert of their own body and their own relationship with their body can then show you and tell you as a researcher. So it's both showing and telling, this is my experience. So maybe have more ownership of that conversation.
Definitely. Yeah, I think it just breaks down, because I think it's just quite an intimidating experience anyway. Like the fact that it's called an interview
Absolutely.
is quite intimidating. And I think because of the sort of stigma that we often experience, I think we can have our guard up quite immediately. And so I think it's really important when you're interviewing the autistic community, very immediately we can be, especially for people like myself who are quite highly masking, it just helps break down so they can share their experiences more openly rather than trying to, they'll often communicate their experiences through a neurotypical lens, and it's like, no, we want to know what it is to have, like, what it is for you as an autistic person. So I really found that it helped kind of break down a lot of those barriers that we often have in research.
Nice. So let's get into the results. So from the paper, I know you identified six themes, and I wonder if you would be happy to share a little of insight from each theme and
Sure, sounds good. So, Might be here for a while. There was so much to unpick. So when I was analyzing this data, I just thought, oh my goodness. So I felt like a huge sense of privilege. Like I had an amazing time doing it and I felt so grateful. And it was a huge learning experience for me and my relationship with my own body. And now I know that sounds like a massive cliche, but honestly, hearing these autistic people was just on like it really was a huge turning point for me and my kind of recovery process and learning my own experience, like my own relationship with my body. So, but there was a lot to uncover. But like you say, there were six themes or six components to having a positive body image. So the first being body connection. And essentially, autistic people often described having like a separation between their mind and their body. So they often had a limited awareness or identification with their, at least their external body. So having awareness of what they look like, or they may feel a bit n not very attuned, quote unquote, to their internal experience. So because of their sensory processing differences, one participant said, so Lucy said, the experience in my body is predominantly sensory based, or certain skin folds, or how certain things touch, and that wasn't ever based on the media says you shouldn't have thighs that touch. It was more like, God, I hate how that feels like. So often, yeah, it's always this kind of narrative that like, oh no, your thighs shouldn't touch because of aesthetic reasons. No, for Lucy, it was because I hate how it feels like. I like maybe in the summer or whatever. It's a very sensory aversive experience. But in order to feel more connected to their body, it was quite different. So the first being understanding their body. So for example, Amelia said, it's knowing that quite a lot of autistics, we have different bodies. And so it's understanding why they experience their body the way that they do. So essentially it's kind of understanding. A huge part of that is understanding their autistic body. And with that, it's having an accepting sort of attitude towards it and like a degree of engaging, of actively learning about oneself. So that would help them learn about how to inhabit their body in their own way. So one participant said, it's kind of a bit of an acceptance that this is how I seem to go about the world. And how my body kind of behaves and how my head works. And so with that, they would then go. So the second sub theme was connecting with their body through physicality. So like I mentioned when discussing what autism is, I mentioned self-regulatory movement. So this is nicknamed stimming. And this is quite like a big sort of way of how they connected with their body. So whilst we understand like exercise and just like joyful movement, that is still very much the case. So people engaged in things like running, hiking, dancing, things like that. But also another way was they did describe stimming as being a huge component to that. So sometimes that will be movement, like I said. So Connor said that he would click his fingers or he would throw things out of his hand, but sometimes it can be verbal. So one word we often use is called echolalia. So we'll say things again and again and again, or we'll hum or make cute little noises, I suppose. I don't know, but to some people that sounds quite strange, but I do it all the time. So I'll be like bah 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 bah, like a weird vowel will just come up in my head. I'm like, oh, I like how that sounds in my head, and I'll make it. And just the sensation of making the noise is quite, I don't know, it just feels really good. And then finally, I'm having like body related agency because of the fact that we are quite stigmatized and discriminated, we can kind of hide away from our own needs. So one participant said, if I was out and about, there might be some kind of self-censorship. So for example, I may not flap my hands in public. So they may withhold from stimming out in public. So they'll like suppress it. And that can make you feel just very disconnected from yourself, basically. And so it's understanding that is what you need and having allowing yourself to just move how you want to. So one participant then said, I can feel the beneficial, nice feeling of stimming, the way that it regulates me, and that it's an option I have to self-soothe. Makes me feel positively about myself and my body because it's quite a useful tool to have. So they're recognizing it like, well, actually, it serves a great purpose for me. And that's actually quite fortunate. They would say, not everyone has that, or at least has an awareness that they can do that, that they can just start stimming and immediately feel so much better in themselves. So why not just utilize that and just go for it? So ever since doing this study, I've been like, screw it, I'm not stim and have a great time doing it. So the next theme, as I've sort of been mentioning, is body acceptance. So allowing their body to just be. So that is also not just the aesthetic, so accepting how their body looks like, but also the sensory aspect. So as one participant said, I feel used to my body. I know what to expect from it and what it feels like and how to take care of it. And so one way of accepting the body was a lot to do with the changes in the body. So that can be quite an uncomfortable experience in their body as well. So very sensitive to any sort of changes. So whether if it looks any different day to day, but also how it feels. So one participant said, any change can be difficult for autistic people, and body changes are not an exception to that. Whether it would be functionality, whether it be how you look, for me, it's learning to accept who we are, alone to accept that the body will change over time as well. So it's having quite a flexible approach to it. And another important aspect to accepting their body was finding a neuroaffirming community and having body acceptance from others. So it's meeting other people who may be autistic themselves or neurodivergent, but also just meeting other people who are accepting of their autistic identity, basically. So one participant said he sort of described an experience where he entered a space where it's predominantly filled with neurodivergent people. And there was kind of a wave of acceptance and seeing that for once, you're not the odd one out. So it's navigating a space where you just, again, feel like that unconditional acceptance. So not just about how their body looks, but also how it, like, in terms of its appearance, but how it looks, like in terms of expressing their autistic characteristics. Another theme was appreciating the functionality of their body, but also their neurodivergent strengths. So again, similar to like neurotypical folks, they would appreciate more about what their body can do rather than what it looks like. So they would appreciate the fact that when they would do sports, they would feel really grateful for what their body can accomplish. But interestingly, another thing they expressed was appreciating what their autistic mind was capable of. So for autistic people, they kind of would describe that they would be able to think really fast, quite creatively, or just differently, to be honest. So one participant said, I've been able to learn weightlifting, which is sometimes quite technical. I like that my brain tells my body and can learn this stuff. So it's almost like another component to it. So they'd be grateful that the body is able to perform the execution of weightlifting, but actually like the technicalities within the mind of piecing it all together. And another participant then said, so there's two sorts of exercise a person can take. That's physical exercise or mental exercise. I'm far more interested in furthering my knowledge and thinking processes and all that sort of thing, rather than how much weight I can lift. So it's the mental lifting as well that they tend to appreciate. So that's when things like writing poetry or like creating art and things like that can also like can play quite a good role in appreciating their functionality. The next thing was having a protective filter for the body. So again, like the rest of the population, they would be really critical of appearance ideals, which was amazing to hear. And me personally, I wasn't surprised whatsoever, but for some other folks, it was surprising for some reason. And so they would be very much aware of the fact that appearance ideals exist, and they would just be slate them, and it was brilliant. So one participant said, unrealistic is too mild of a word for what it is. So but why the participants felt so strongly was harder for me to kind of describe, but then a participant brilliantly said it's often talked about in the autistic community that there's kind of a predilection of a desire for truthfulness and for authenticity. And that uni manifests in autistic communities as unrelenting demands for justice and equity. And I cannot emphasize enough how we have a very strong burning desire for justice. And I think that's what makes us very intense people, perhaps, but very good advocates and very good for like pushing change, because we just say it how it is. We're able to cut the bluff and just see it with laser focused, like just very attuned to it, basically. And Beauty Ideals was just no exception to that. Another way this manifested was knowledge is power. So they did lots of reading of like critical discourse against like things like feminism. Loads of participants were really aware of health at every size. And we're speaking of just like the general population. So not all of these people were like postgrads in this in the psychology field. Like they were just general folks. I'm not saying like you can't have this sort of knowledge, but I guess living in my own little bubble, sometimes I just think, does anyone know about health at every size? It appears not, unfortunately. But no, these people were very much engaged in that sort of dialogue, and so that really kind of fed into their attitudes of like having and like protecting their own body image. And then finally, they would have like almost an innate capacity to disengage from appearance-related pressures because of being autistic. We're just very equipped at just, I guess, being in our own world, to be honest, and just not giving much two hoots. And so one participant neatly said, I was just very involved with my own special interests, and that became a very insular thing, which to some people might be quite a negative thing. But they went on to say, as a result, I wasn't aware of the trends in media, in appearances, in makeup trends. I just wasn't aware of it whatsoever. So it sometimes it's a conscious act of disengaging, and sometimes it's just like this innate ability to just not care, which was amazing to hear. The next theme was taking care of the body. So this is where things kind of get a bit sticky for the autistic community. So some would just like, what does it mean to you? And whilst it was described in no different ways as we would usually expect, it manifested in two different ways. So the first would be listening to the body. So one participant said, it involves actually listening to what your body wants. If I start to feel tired, that means I give it vitamins. If I start to feel cranky and restless, that means I take it for a walk. Almost, and they went on to describe like it's like my body is a dog, so it'll woof and I'll respond to it, which I can understand. But because of some people's body awareness and sensory differences, sometimes that isn't always accessible. And so the second part or second sub theme is the need for routine. So for those who might find that quite difficult of just being attuned or intuitive to their body needs, they would maybe because that actually resulted in inadvertent neglect of their body. So like I've sort of described, of forgetting to eat or drink. So instead, what they would often do is adaptively kind of use strategies to compensate for that based on their own bodily needs. So for example, they would use external reminders as like a timer, or like I've mentioned before, having a glass, like a visual cue to remind me. Often people would eat the same thing or follow almost like a meal plan. So this is where things can get a bit tricky for eating disorders, because that can appear as like as aphid pathology, where you just eat the same thing and very regimented and really inflexible. But actually, that's just so they meet their nutritional and sensory needs. So they'll eat foods that they feel safe to eat. So one participant said, I eat the same every day because it's almost like a comfort thing. It's just the fact that I already know the food. I know what the texture is like. I know how strong it is and stuff like that. So things like vegetables can be a little bit go haywire, and you'll eat a strawberry, that's amazing. And then the next minute you'll eat another and it's mushy and you're just like, oh God, that's awful.
very unpredictable.
Yeah. And yeah, it's kind of managing that and kind of avoiding any sort of like negative experience that comes with that. And finally, it's body and appearance neutrality. Now, this has become like a bit of a hot topic in body image literature. However, whilst in the literature, we understand neutrality is like almost like acceptance, or even almost like a form of like flexibility, so psychological flexibility, it works a bit differently. So what I mean by neutrality is it's very much an effective component. So it relates to like the emotional component of one's body image. And it's complicated by two things. The first being the alexithymia. So sometimes people would have a neutral feeling towards their body because they aren't able to necessarily identify and describe the feeling that they're experiencing. So as one participant said, what does make me feel positive about my body is a lot harder to put into words. So it is literally like the best way to put it is they would just feel neutral. And then in contrast, they would feel emotions quite intensely. So feel really strongly and negatively. So feel really quite physically distressed. Or they would feel like intense elation and intense joy, which is amazing. But either emotions can actually feel so overwhelming and overstimulating that they just want to avoid it, regardless of whether it's positive or negative.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just, one participant says, it's just trying to neutralize my emotional feelings, I suppose. So just feeling, it almost sounds like it's emotional avoidance, but actually one participant said it's instead a sense of sameness and stability and clarity and unity, no matter what kind of day I'm experiencing. Neutrality gives you that consistency, and through that consistency comes flexibility to be like, I hate my shins today, but God will I love them in a week when I go on my next run.
Mm-hmm.
So it can actually have quite an adaptive way to go about it. And that for me personally was like a huge light bulb moment because, like I've been saying, I equally don't like the positive experiences to the negative ones sometimes. I just want to feel chill and calm. And so, yeah, it can actually be, in certain contexts, it can actually be quite a positive strategy to feel positive about the body. And so that is a very long-winded overview.
I loved it. I could have you speak to me all day about this. I was hanging on your every word, and I so appreciated you giving quotes to really illustrate each of those six themes, because I think it really helped paint that audio picture, at least, of what we're getting at. And this is because this is such a new topic, and there's so much we don't know, and I feel like I've just learned so much listening to you share that. And I guess it's so interesting, and you've been so generous about sharing your own experience as well as someone who is autistic. What for you was the most surprising finding from that qualitative work that you did? Or was it all quite, I know you said it was quite validating to hear, but maybe not surprising?
No, I don't. At least for me, I was like, "Oh yeah." I think the thing is that it's because of my own alexithymia. It was just putting words to my experiences. I was like, "So that's what it is." Like, it was just so validating and so like so much of it. I was just like, it just all so many were pennies were dropping. It was just it was a really overwhelming time. I suppose it's not necessarily surprising, but the thing that took the longest time to really figure out what was going on was the neutrality component. So for ages, me and my supervisors were trying to decipher what exactly is going on here. They're describing something. They keep saying they're not that interested. Some people just weren't interested in their appearance. Mm. They didn't care. And then sometimes they would describe like these intense emotional reactions, whether it was positive or negative. It's like, so they do care, but they don't care. Like, what's going on here? So I think the neutrality component was the last thing that really kind of like was, I guess, identified, so to speak. And when when that penny finally dropped, I think that was actually, it was like a nice nugget of knowledge. And I think even more so because body neutrality is gaining a lot of attention at the moment, it was the fact that, as always, as with many autistic experiences, there was like a twist to it, and it's articulating that twist. And even when it was being reviewed, this paper, it's like, well, how do you differentiate that from like body acceptance from the appearance? Like, it just sounds like acceptance. It's like, actually, no, it's just like I guess a form of like a body image flexibility, because we go on to discuss like we have like these negative body image threats. So, for example, exposure to negative body talk, fat talk, bullying about our appearance. Like, these are all worthwhile body image threats for autistic people, but even more so, they emphasize the role of like the aversive internal experiences. And it's just having like a strategy of how to see us through those experiences, because they're just unavoidable. Like, you'll eat a meal and you'll feel really uncomfortable by the digestion of that food. Like, there's no way of avoiding that. So rather than saying, oh, actually, I'll just won't engage with that person who is fat phobic, you can't get away from digesting your own food. So it's just having that new neutral experience of like, okay, so this is just what I'm gonna have to kind of see myself through. So yeah, in a way, I kind of feel like it's a nice way of expanding body image flexibility to the internal perspective for autistic people, but also just for people in general, I feel.
Yeah, I think there's lots of learnings here that extend. So thank you again for sharing all of that in such depth, because I think, as we've been saying, it's so new and there are all of these nuances that haven't been discussed, so I think it's so valuable to hear about it in detail. So let's transition and talk about the adaptation of the body appreciation scale, the version two that you developed for autistic adults. And I wonder, because I think it really helps our listeners understand what we're talking about, would you be happy to share and read out the final 12 questions before we discuss them further?
Sure. So again, back in the day when I first started getting into body image research, I remember coming across the BAS 2, and absolutely no offense to Tracy Tilker's work and Nicola's work whatsoever. Like, they are just icons in my eyes. But often I would look at this, this isn't just limited to the BAS 2, this is like with all sorts of measures. I would look at scale items and go, what? So yeah, this just seemed like the natural next step for my PhD. So what we did is we asked some autistic folks in the community to kind of give their feedback. So I thought, I can't just be, am I alone in this experience in interpreting? So again, having some participatory involvement from the community. And based on this feedback, we revised and created the following 12 scale items. So one being, I appreciate my body, its appearance, and its sensations. Two, I feel that my body has many good qualities. Three, I take a positive attitude towards my body. Four, I accept my body just the way it is, even if its physical appearance and or sensations change over time. Five, I value the different and unique characteristics of my body. Six, I am grateful for my body, even if it has different needs to other people. Seven, I feel confident expressing myself and moving my body freely without hiding my autistic characteristics, for example, stimming. I appreciate how my body works and moves the way that it does. Nine, I am grateful that I can experience joy within my body, for example, while dancing, listening to music, or laughing. Ten, I protect my positive attitude towards my body by ignoring harmful societal messages to change my appearance. 11, I treat my body with care, even during difficult experiences, for example, when I'm feeling overstimulated. And 12, I think my body is wonderful, even if I look different from images or social media influencers, models, actors, and so on.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you for reading those out. And I think it will be, even if listeners aren't familiar with the original BAS2, there are certainly some of the items, some of those questions that stand out as being maybe what you've adapted for autistic adults. So, you know, when you're referencing autistic characteristics like stimming or the bodily sensations, which we've been speaking quite a lot about throughout this conversation. But I wonder if you can just speak more fully about what were the main adaptations to the original BAS2?
So first off was just giving... So some of the language used was quite ambiguous and very almost ethereal is probably the best way to put them. And so they can be a little bit too abstract. I think even just for some neurotypical, but particularly for autistic people, it's like, what does comfort mean? So we love certainty. We need accuracy. Maybe it's from anxiety, from... We just want to avoid miscommunication or any kind of negative judgment. But also, we just need to know the details of everything and anything. And so it's just being very, very clear cut. So, for example, item one of the BAS2, I think the original BAS2 is, I respect my body. And so autistic people would say, well, what do you mean by respect? Like, what does that look like? Could you give me an example of what that encompasses? And also, what do you mean by respect? Like, do I, in my head, speaking autistically, I think, do I bow? It's just a little bit vague. A few elements of the scale items is they refer to skills or processes that aren't in either accessible to autistic people. So, for example, listening to their body's needs. So some people might find that difficult, or it might actually be a negative experience. So listening to the hunger cues, listening to your thirst and listening to your tiredness and things like that, and trying to respond to them actually isn't always a positive experience. Sometimes we don't actually want to pay attention to those sensations. And so it then actually counteracts being appreciative of your body. So it's just kind of tailoring them or tailoring those items to just kind of accommodate or acknowledge those differences. So there's a lot of scale items that would say, for example, and that is just to make it really clear, or just to kind of, because sometimes the scale items are still quite abstract. So giving them a behavioral example just kind of puts it into context for them, and to then interpret and go, well, I might not do that, but I guess I do this day to day. Yes, I do that quite a lot, or I don't do that at all. So yeah. I think those are the main sort of adaptations that we had to make.
Yeah, really nice. And I also noticed that you slightly amended the response options. So we've got all of those 12 items, and then when people are responding, that they're responding on a sliding scale. And I really liked how you amended it and made it visual as well. And I know this is perhaps a little difficult to do via audio or in an audio format, but I wonder if you could explain and describe the amended response options and that visual that you provided to go along with it.
Yeah. So at the moment, there is a huge push just to make psychometric scales or measures more accessible for autistic people, but also those with an intellectual or learning disability. So just a side note, a certain proportion of the autistic community will have a co-occurring intellectual disability. The percentage varies very much differently, and it's very unclear at the moment, so I won't dive into that rabbit hole. But there is some new recent guidelines that have been formatted for researchers who want to do the psychometric work. And so following these recommendations, it's paying attention to the fact that certain ways of how scales have been traditionally developed aren't that accessible for autistic people. And one of the ways in which that manifests is being able to respond to the scale items. So often there's certain terminology that can be quite confusing. So I will never be able to tell you what seldom means. Seldom is a word that confuses the life out of me. And so sometimes it can create anxiety of being able to know accurately what it is that you want to say and how you want to answer it. So in these guidelines, one of the recommendations they say is to be quite attentive to making the response options as clear as possible, because sometimes autistic people can be particularly anxious about responding accurately. And one of the ways to kind of make that easier is to be a bit clearer in the response options that you give. So we amended it to none of the time to all of the time. And it's been recommended to use a visual aid. So we got permission from the creator to implement this visual aid into the scale. So, because sometimes it's like, well, what do these responses look like? So, like, how do you differentiate between some of the time to most of the time? Like, or from none of the time to all of the time, like even the most contrasting times. And so basically the visual aid we used is a cup. So it's like the more time you spend, the more, let's use cherry Pepsi, the more cherry Pepsi you're pouring into your cup. So more Pepsi you've got, I love Pepsi, more or the more you are appreciative of your body.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. Sometimes people can use like the visual aid of faces. Mm-hmm. So like none of the time might be a really upset face to all of the time a really, really happy face. But because of things like alexithymia, that can make it even more confusing. So for me personally, whenever someone gives me that smiling face scale, I always press the middle, because that is actually how I always feel. It's just very neutral, even though I'm like, yeah, I feel great, and it's like, great, so are you smiling? No. I'm just really,
that's interesting,
really deadpan, but I'm like, yeah, I feel amazing, deadpan. So that is why we refer to the filled cup. Sometimes you can use percentages, but that can actually, with psychometrics, that it's, you have to pay such careful consideration of how you create the response options, because it comes with, that introduces complexities with things like if you wanted it to be a trait construct or state construct. And also sometimes using things like a slider where you'll use like a percentage, that still actually can be quite problematic. So I'm really weird with sliders, so I'm like, it has to be like an even number, or it actually creates a bit more anxiety. So we felt like this was the best way.
Well, yeah, I can imagine with a slider, because then to what you were saying before about, you know, that anxiety about wanting to get it right to accurately represent what you, how you feel, it's like, well, am I at 60% or 62%? I don't know. You know, that it's I can appreciate that, but I, as I said, I really like that visual aid with the cup. So the none of the time being like an empty cup, the all the time being a full cup, and then with the variations in between. I mean, I'm not autistic, but found that really useful. I actually think it could be useful on all scales for everyone.
Yeah, yeah. No, I've really found that, and I feel like it should be something considered universally. Like, you don't have to have, like, this was specifically recommended for those with a co-occurring intellectual disability. But I just think sometimes these words, like, what do you, I just can't get over, like, the comparison between never and seldom. It's just, yeah. It, sometimes just having that assistance is just helpful for everyone.
Well, that's it. And it just makes me think, why not have it? If it helps even 3, 4, 5% of a sample, it's not hurting anyone by having it. So just have it in there. But I actually think it will help a lot more than that very small percentage, because it is just that, it's just a quicker cue, isn't it? I think a lot of people respond to a visual cue faster than like reading a lot of text. So
yeah. Definitely.
So yeah, that's awesome. So we've spoken about so much, and we could so easily speak for another hour, but I want to be respectful of your time and let you get on with other things. But I'm just so appreciative of this conversation. I feel like I've learned a lot throughout this conversation. Before I get to my very last question about cake, I want to just check in and just see if there's anything that you've not managed to share about body image in autistic communities, in autistic people, that we haven't been able to cover yet. Is there anything that you'd like to add before we wrap up?
So I've been doing some really exciting initial work with Dr. Blair Burnett, who is based at Michigan State University. And there is a huge kind of overlap between positive body image and intuitive eating. And that is something that I cannot wait to dig my teeth into because I find the concept of intuitive eating, it has always fascinated me. Probably because it's mysterious to me. I'm like, oh, what is that? I will never understand. And I just think it has the capacity to be amazing for universally for all people, but particularly for autistic people because of like the points I've made about differentiating between eating disorders and autistic needs. I just feel like putting a we need something strength-based in this community and like affirmative and like neuroaffirming strategy for this group. And I feel like intuitive eating has such great potential, but unfortunately, a lot of autistic folks are seeing it in the way that it's kind of currently framed and perceiving it as being ableist, which to some degrees it is, because it does rely a lot on things like interoceptive awareness and not having a alexithymia and all of these other crooks and crannies. But at the same time, the very core of intuitive eating and the framework, I think, has like such a great potent has such great potential to improve the well-being of the autistic community and really get us to lean into our needs. In a, like it's incredible that we can actually even mask our own eating. Like, so we'll change the way we eat to just fit in into society because I don't think it's still socially acceptable for a lot of people to eat chicken tenders every day. I love chicken tenders. Leave me alone.
That's so funny.
I love eating broccoli every day. I love eating the
Yeah.
same thing every day. I eat like a kid. Potato smileys, stop throwing shade at me. Leave me alone.
Nice.
And I think since in as part of my eating disorder recovery, a huge way of like meeting my nutritional needs and just kind of moving further along into recovery has been learning to eat intuitively, and it just looks quite differently. But being accepting of myself and accepting those needs has been like a huge like help, and I just feel like yeah, we just need a bit more research into this field, and this is where I hope me and Blair and many other folks, not just me and Blair, but yeah, it's one thing I'm really excited to kind of uncover.
Yeah.
So just a heads up for listeners, keep an eye out.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's such important work. And it kind of brings us back kind of full circle because we were talking about eating disorders and in autistic people earlier. So kind of flipping it to that more strength-based conversation as well to think about intuitive eating is so valuable. So yeah, absolutely, we'll be looking out for that. And yeah, thank you so much for sharing. And I think before I ask my final question, I keep putting it off, but I'm just enjoying this conversation so much. And what I'm just really thinking about, it's so incredible to see you thrive. I remember speaking when you were a master's student whilst you were applying for a PhD, and I just feel like you have really just come into your own, at least from an external perspective, and just yeah, are really thriving and doing such incredible, important work. So it's just so good to see, and so wonderful to be speaking with you about all of this important work that you're doing.
Thank you. I wish I felt that way. I feel like a shell of a person.
Oh, I mean, I feel like that's the universal PhD experience. But you get through it and you come out at the other end, but you're just really excelling and just making such important contributions to the field that are so needed. And then if you think then what the impact of that will be for so many people. And actually a lot of what we've been talking about is we're saying like obviously the priority is for autistic people. Like that's the center of your work. But there are things that you're adding that I think others
Yeah,
can benefit from.
I hope so.
So I really believe so. So yeah, just want to say yeah, keep going, because I know how a PhD can feel. But yeah, just keep doing what you're doing, because you're, yeah, just doing such a great job. Which brings me now on to my final question. And I know you are familiar with the podcast, so you know what's coming. But at the Centre for Appearance Research, we do have a weekly coffee session together where we are all in the office and we take it in turns to bring in cake. So what this means is that as a team, we are deeply invested in cake and cake choices. So I'm interested to know, on behalf of the team, what's your favourite cake?
I've got three things to say about this question, which I find hilarious. It's the first thing is, I'm so antisocial, you would not find me at this cake meeting. Okay. I'll be like, cool, I'll take whatever I need and see you later.
Nice. Okay, good to know.
And eat in a quiet garden. Yeah. And then come back and be like, oh, that was really lovely, thank you so much. Not to be too rude. The second thing is, I can't remember the three points. But anyway, I'm not a huge cake eater. However, if I wasn't a researcher, I mean this wholeheartedly, I would probably go into cookery school and train as a pastry chef.
Nice.
So it wouldn't necessarily be cake, but I do love baking. It would probably be instead, like, we'll have a huge, huge pot of black coffee and loads of posh almond croissants.
Ooh. I mean, I think that will go down very, very well. And also, I think in the morning, I think that lends itself very nicely.
But if it has to be cake, then probably carrot cake with like a big wad of like proper good cream cheese
icing. Nice.
Yeah. But I took this question way too seriously.
No.
Really, I gave this more thought than the actual research itself.
No, it is appreciated. As I said, the whole team are deeply invested in cake. And so I know the team, when they're listening, will greatly enjoy your response to that question. So
thank you
so much. And thank you so much again for speaking with me. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you for listening to me waffle. I've had a blast. I feel knackered, but thank you.
Okay, so that's it for this episode. I really hope you enjoyed listening to Fedra as much as I did. And so a big thank you once again to Fedra for speaking with me for the podcast and sharing so much about autism and body image in autistic individuals. And so then that just leaves me to say thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning in to listening to the podcast. And remember, it really does make a difference if you share the episode with someone who you think will take something away from this conversation. And it also really does mean a lot if you are able to rate and review the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Until next time, bye!